This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. My name is Patsy Gill. It is my great honor today to have as my guest Juan Felipe Herrera, who has recently appointed the U.S. Poet Laureate. He officially takes his position in September, so I am excited to be able to talk to him now about what he plans to do with this new position of his. He was already the Poet Laureate for California for 2 years and a professor at the University of California, Riverside. Professor Herrera.
Hello there.
Thank you so much for joining me. I played a little harmonica music there to introduce you because I know that you love harmonica music, as I do. My father also played harmonica music, which I know your father did.
That's right. You know, I still remember my father playing harmonica, and he sure made the harmonica sound like a little orchestra, and I always wondered how he did it, you know, because it was making different sounds and different rhythms. And so I ended up picking up a harmonica back when I was probably in sixth grade.
Well, it was, to me, the same thing. It was like so magical how that all that sound could come out of that little harmonica. It's a wonderful memory for us. So although we grew up in very different locations, I grew up in Michigan's Upper Peninsula, and you in the valleys of California, we actually have quite a bit in common, and I want to talk about that after a little while. But first, let's talk about this wonderful appointment, which is so well-deserved. How did it feel to be nominated the U.S. Poet Laureate and then get selected?
Well, you know, it was an incredible feeling. It's an incredible feeling. It's like facing the ocean, you know, and you see a big tidal wave, and it comes to you, and it's overwhelming. At the same time, it's incredible. At the same time, it's really refreshing and strengthening. So I felt all those things all at once when Dr. James Billington, head of the Library, Library of Congress, gave me a call.
Wow. What did once you were told that you had been selected, what did you do? What did you do, something special? Did you have a party? Did you go out and dance in the streets? It's an exciting thing. It's so historical. And of course, being the first Chicano, I mean, this has to be, you have to have a celebration for this.
Well, you know, I think I'm working up to it. I'm working up to it now that you mentioned dancing on the streets. That's a really good idea, you know, dancing and poetry on the streets.
Absolutely.
That's a very good idea. I was at the University of Washington teaching for a quarter at the American Ethnic Studies program, which is an amazing place, beautiful faculty. So that's where I was, and that's when I got the call in the office, my office up there. And there was a little celebrations, you know, little celebrations. The faculty kind of surprised me, and they were very kind. I walked into the lounge, faculty lounge, and they had a whole thing going, and they surprised me. They had, you know, good, you know, Mexican food and some beautiful treats and some Japanese, you know, good food, too, and we had a great time. So I had a little good, warm celebration, and now that you mentioned dancing in the streets, I think I'm going
to... You have to do it. You know, it's funny, when I heard that you had been selected, of course, I had been familiar with your work before, and I'll tell you a little later why I knew your work. But okay. So somehow the first image I got was dancing in the street. And I hope that you and maybe I have to send this in as a suggestion. I know the official... presentation, or I don't know what they do. They don't crown you with a laurel wreath, but there should be dancing in the mall. You know, they should really get out there and get some you know, great Mexican music out there, and everybody should be dancing in the mall, because I think it's a wonderful thing to celebrate your position, that you've gotten this position. You know, it's being the first Latino, it took a little bit of time, if you ask me, but I think that it's finally, it's arrived to the right person. Your work is amazing, and you've been so prolific, not just with your poetry, but also your wonderful children's books, which I love.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. You know, that I love to write for children and young people and everybody. And let's do that. Let's get together up in D.C. on the mall and on September 15th, and let's do some dancing. And, you know, there is going to be some good old solid Mexican music taking place. I believe we're going to be doing some corridos, you know, some ballads, and I think I'm going to write one while I'm at it for everybody, you know, for the people. So now that you're really inspiring me, I'm gonna.
You have to put it together because it'd be great. This is the kind of thing that I think can bring people together to celebrate the joy that you know comes from. Well, comes from your background, you know, although you had a difficult childhood and, you know, and it wasn't easy, it's amazing, you know, what one can accomplish in life. And so I think there's a lot to be celebrated here.
Well, you know, thank you so much for saying that, you know, because you're very inspiring and I'm so glad to be on your program. But, you know, you're right. Guess what happened two days ago? I was going to say yesterday, but I was so throttled by it. It was my third grade teacher, Mrs. Sampson, who gave me a call yesterday. And she said, well, guess what? I'm 94 years old. And I had been looking for her because when I wrote The Upside Down Boy, it was all about her. It was all about how one day in third grade, in Lowell Elementary in San Diego, California, in Logan Heights Barrio. You know, I had never really spoken up, and I had, you know, been criticized and, you know, kind of just pushed back by it because I spoke in Spanish only. So by the time I hit third grade, I was really kind of just downcast, not doing much, but I was very, you know, curious about everything. And she invited me up to sing in front of class. She had been playing some gospel music on a phonograph and Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. And but when I got there up in front of that class, somehow she was so kind and her words were so warm and she was so encouraging that I actually managed to get up there. And I turned around. I didn't sing the gospel songs. That came later at the end of the year. But I did sing Three Blind Mice. And she turned to me when I did that. She turned to me. And this is what changed my entire life from that day on. She turned to me and she said, "You have a beautiful voice." And I it was like she blessed me. Oh, she gave me the magic touch. And then I went back and I sat down. And from that day forward, those words were just moving inside of me. And by seventh grade or eighth grade, I pushed myself into choir because I wanted to get my voice out, like she had said. And as you can see, that's what I'm doing. And that's what I'm encouraging others to do, is to express their beautiful voices. So Mrs. Sampson called me yesterday.
Wow, that's so beautiful. And it's funny, you know, I know your third grade memory is very important to you. And it's wonderful that she's alive to see what's happened with you. Now, my third grade teacher is also very important because, as I mentioned, I grew up in northern Michigan, and we were very poor. And when we were in third grade was the year that we came down to Detroit, to live in Detroit. And coming from northern Michigan, I didn't know we had an accent. But apparently, we had an accent. So when I got to Detroit in third grade, I had this up north, we call it up north accent, and people made fun of me, much like they made fun of you. And unfortunately, I didn't have a nice third grade teacher. I won't mention her name, but I remember it well. I'm left-handed, and she made me sit on my left hand for the first 2 months of third grade.
Oh.
So I didn't have a wonderful Miss Sampson, and so you were very, very lucky to have someone that inspired you. Of course, in some ways, my third grade teacher inspired me not to listen to people, because eventually my father walked in and just took one look at her, and that was the end of that. I wish he had played his harmonica to really show off, but that was the end of me sitting on my hand. But that shows how important teachers are, and I know that for you, you know, one of the things is that you love to work with children. And why I love your children's books, if language books were written like your children's book, with this, you write with the English, there's English on, you know, part of it, and then right below or right next to it is the Spanish, and it's even if you don't speak Spanish, you find yourself reading Spanish. You think, what am I doing? I can go from the English to the Spanish and back and forth, and it seems so seamless.
Yes, that's right. You know, it is seamless. You know, all languages are music and sound and rhythm, and they come from deep inside. So they're really really us in many ways. They're really everything we are. And you're right. You can go right into the Spanish and make experiments with it, or pronounce it, or just look at it, or notice the words, and little by little you
pick it up. It's beautiful. Yeah. You know, I was a homeschool mom. My boys are now off to college, university, but you know, I love that. I right away recognize something that's really brilliant, and I think your children's books are brilliant. We'll talk later about your writing, your poetry, but as a homeschool mom, I spent, you know, almost between the two boys, almost, you know, 18, 20 years going back and forth teaching them. And, well, of course, I think at a certain point they were teaching me, but still, I recognize something that's so, so wonderful. You know, poetry, you know, people sometimes don't realize how important poetry is to us and in our lives. But it's true, isn't it, that poetry, people search out poetry at certain times in their life?
Well, yes, they do. You know, we search it out, and you know, we go through so many. Our experiences are kind of fountains for poetry. You know, our experiences, especially those that we keep to ourselves, or we all have a quiet self where we just kind of meditate on things, or we see a leaf fall down a tree, or the clouds, or lightning, or something somebody says, and we see things, or we feel things, or we discover something. So poetry then is that place, and where we can put all those discoveries and little insights, or big insights, or maybe just a couple of words that kind of moved us or inspired us, and we put them on that piece of paper or in our journal or on a laptop, and then we can take it from there. Or we want to turn those phrases into a song and our guitar, or just want to sing them, or just simply say them to ourselves and go, oh yes, you have a beautiful voice. I love that phrase. I've never heard it before. And that's where poetry lives, and it's so beautiful.
Yeah, one of the reasons I started this program, which is called Joy on Paper, is to encourage people and to motivate them to sit down and to put the words on paper, because there is nothing so wonderful as seeing your words written, and even if they don't get published, at least you've accomplished something. But of course, to try to get them published, and well, when I started this program on the very first show, I was encouraging people. I said, if you don't, you know, just start slow. Maybe just enter a contest. You know, write something small, a short story or poem, whatever. And lo and behold, and 2 months later, a young woman came to me and said, I entered the Writer's Digest poetry contest. She had finally realized, you know, she'd been jotting poems down, and she went ahead and did it. And she's feeling so great about herself. And that's why I know that you, of course, have been encouraging, and now as a poet laureate, it's really... It gives you sort of a open door to the national media to help, you know, to encourage people to write. In California, you, of course, did a very interesting project called the Unity Poem Project. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yes. You know, that was, I drafted some ideas for the California Poet Laureate Project. And I was in a class, my poetry workshop class at UC Riverside in Riverside, California. And I asked the students, well, which title do you like for a project? I have a number of ideas. Which one really comes out at you? And they go, oh, we like that one, the biggest and most incredible poem on unity in the world. They like that one. I go, okay, then I'm going to go for that one. And that's what it was. I called on everybody, all ages, writers, non-writers, speakers, people that like phrases, anyone, everyone, to send a word or a phrase or a line or a whole poem that they felt was all about unity for them. And that's what happened. People started sending me lines and phrases and stanzas and poems or writings. And also things started happening in the world. Well, they're always happening, but it started happening when I started the project. Sandy Hook, the terrible Sandy Hook event that took place where children got, you know, killed and teachers and on, you know, big ships started sinking with people and a bus went up in flames up here in California with students. And I said, it would be good if we sent a poem to those communities and families if possible, or simply just put them up and write those poems of friendship and support. So a lot of those poems started being written. The typhoon in the Philippines that really devastated Tacloban, and a lot of people suffered and passed away. So we began a Facebook page called Hawak Kamay, which in Filipino means holding hands. Let us hold hands. So around 1,500 to 1,600 people joined that Facebook page to comfort each other and to write poems for each other and to write poems for families that they wanted to embrace with a poem. So that unity poem was all these poems put together, and it ended up being around on pages. It ended back-to-back pages. It ended up being around 200 pages back-to-back, and it's a lot of poetry with a lot of voices. And of course, at the end of the 2 years, we had a Unity Fiesta at UC Riverside, and a high school came over from Long Beach with all their poems. The whole school wrote a giant Unity poem, and I encouraged them to voice it up in a choir formation together, and they did. They sang it out, and they spoke it out, and I got a couple of elementary schools did that too, so that's what it was all about. It was contributing, writing, and supporting others, and coming together in groups and voicing out our poetry, unity poetry, the biggest one in the world.
Oh, that's, you know, it's wonderful, and I'm sure that you're coming out with ideas for your time as the U.S. Poet Laureate. It's nice. I think it's great that you're what we call an activist poet. You're out there. You're not. You're certainly not shy, and you're performance oriented, which is great because it really helps to open the doors for people. And you know, although everyone you know always refers to you as the Chicano poet, the truth is you cross over into so many areas. You know, I don't want people to sort of think, oh well, he's just writing Chicano poetry or poetry about you know strawberry picking. Because you cross so many into so many areas, for example, in your Senegal Taxi, which is a completely not California story. Can you tell us a little bit about Senegal Taxi? How did you come up with that idea?
Well, you know, Senegal Taxi, I was at the Montalvo Art Center. I had a one-month residency in Saratoga, California, by San Jose, California. And, you know, there I was. I bought some India ink. I bought some Japanese bamboo pens, giant fountain pens, almost as big as your elbow or up to your elbow, but maybe as big as your hand or a little further up. And I got pens and pencils and paper and newsprint. I was really excited. I was going to do something artistic, but I didn't know what it was. And I remember I had seen a really, really good photographic article in the National Geographic. Of course, I had heard about Darfur and the Sudan and all the tragedies and massacres and villages being burned and families being killed and children and women running away as fast as they could and men and being put in refugee camps. I had heard about it, but when I saw this article and I was in this residency and I had these pens and inks, I said, you know what, I'm going to write about that. And I started throwing ink on paper, big paper, and making big splashes and blowing on it and using my Japanese bamboo pens to, you know, just make shapes and do things with it. Then I was ready to go, and I started writing. And I said, I want to talk about three children and a mother that are running away from their village because it's been destroyed, and they're trying to get to Senegal because Senegal is on the west coast. And if you get to Senegal from Darfur, if you manage to make it, it's an incredible, impossible journey across, you know, scorching deserts and I don't know what to call them, you know, groups or gangs that are there to take advantage of people as they make that trek. They're very violent experiences. And once they get to Senegal, they can get to the Canary Islands. Of course, you have to get there, you know, in some kind of boat and with what resources. And once you get there, there's a possible chance of getting on another boat all the way to Barcelona, Spain. Imagine that trick. And from there, just maybe you can figure it out, make it to New York. So that's a journey. So I wrote about those children and their mother, and I took on their voices, and I figured, well, you know, there's more to this story. So I selected a Kalashnikov machine gun, and which is the machine gun that's used by the paramilitary Janjaweed to kill. So I said, yeah, I think that weapon has a lot to say. So I gave that weapon a voice, and I also gave the ants, the little biting ants that crawl around on the earth, a voice, and also the flies. I gave them a voice, and on. And even put in a newscaster, and they're called Bart Crimson. And I figured if I can make all these voices come out, and with all these characters, maybe I'll be able to get to at least the very, very top layer of what's going on. Not the deep layers, because I was never there. And I don't have all the info, and I'm very limited, extremely limited. But I figure I still have to make an attempt.
But the artist,
that's what I did.
The artist's mind and the you speak with an sort of an international understanding, a universal understanding that a poet has of the human heart, and that's what makes it such a great work. And I'm sure, you know, I want to encourage people to, I always encourage people to read poetry because it is so, you are reading something and suddenly it just hits you. Yes, that makes sense to me. That's something I should know about. And so that's, of course, one of your great works. And one of, you know, I know that you were influenced a great deal by Allen Ginsberg, right?
Well, you know, indeed, you know, I thought he was a great guy and a great writer, of course, and a very free and open writer, and great lines and great images, and just went for everything and didn't hold back. I liked his freedom and his openness. I liked his journeys to India and his voice and how he used instruments. As he read and wrote calypso, wrote blues and sang and was in parades and didn't have any problem talking about his sexual orientation and was very, very concerned with people's lives and social change and peace. So all that made a lot of sense to me when I first read some of his work maybe back in the late 60s. Of course, I always liked Pablo Neruda as well, and Cesar Vallejo, and Latin American poets, and world poets, poets, of course, in the United States. You know, I have always been moved by people's writing.
Well,
Allen Ginsberg definitely got to me in the late 60s.
Of course, Neruda was a very activist poet and politically active.
That's true.
But you haven't gone into politics, huh?
You don't see yourself running
for president, huh?
No, I see myself running with poets.
that's good. I think we have enough people running for president. We need more poets. I have to take a short break, but please hold on, because when we come back, I want to talk about your upbringing and, of course, your mother, who was a great influence on you. So we'll just take a 1 minute break. Hold on.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi. I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
Are you looking for the perfect gift? Going to a wedding? A special birthday? The Silver Queen is the place to go. Don't settle for the ordinary. At the Silver Queen, you will find a unique gift. Things that you won't find at the mall. From beautiful photo frames to silver and china. Guys, looking for that perfect ring? You'll find it at the Silver Queen. And don't forget their bridal registry. Located at 1350 West Bay Drive in Largo. Visit their website, silverqueen.com. They have some wonderful coupons. And when you go to the store, tell them that Patsy with a Z sent you.
At the Oaks of Clearwater, you'll enjoy a lifestyle to fit your needs. From independent living, assisted living, memory care, and skilled nursing. Our exciting independent lifestyle is the perfect combination of freedom, comfort, and security. Enjoy total independence with peace of mind. Our independent lifestyle includes chef-prepared meals in our beautiful waterfront dining room, a continental breakfast, all utilities, including cable and telephone, housekeeping with linen service, scheduled transportation, including trips for shopping, local restaurants, theater, and more. Our activities program is second to none. At the Oaks of Clearwater, you'll enjoy affordable luxury waterfront senior living with a $1 million view. Call today, 727-445-4069, and discover where caring, compassionate service really makes the difference.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I'm back with my very special guest, the new poet laureate, Juan Felipe Herrera. Hi, Juan. Are you there?
Hey, Patsy.
Great.
Yes, I am.
Well, you know, you're going to be interviewed over the next year many, many times by many people, but there are very few of the people who interview you who can really say that they understand what it was like for your mother. Who, of course, both of your parents were working the fields of California, as you picked crops and so it was not an easy life. And when I was 13 and 14, the summers I was 13 and 14, I joined a migrant working crew and picked the strawberry season in Michigan, but I worked with the adults. I didn't want any favors, and I worked the entire season, and I know what it is like to pick a zillion strawberries.
So even now I
know the back-breaking work of it, so I imagine that for you it was difficult, and of course your parents both worked in the fields. What? Tell me about your mother. I know she was such an influence on and really got you started into poetry.
That's true. You know, that's true. I'm an only child, and I'm also a left-hander. And you're right about my mother. I'm glad you bring her up because she really deserves a lot of credit. She looked after me day after day. She protected me day after day. She cured me day after day whenever I got sick or had some kind of infection or my toe was all messed up or I had a fever. And she also sang to me from very early on. And she would have a lot of refrains and proverbs and riddles and stories and taught me how to read in Spanish and the ABCs in Spanish from the beat-up secondhand store language primer in Spanish. And so that's in songs.
And her name was?
Her name was Lucha.
Lucha. I love that name.
Lucha. Lucha. It's from Luz. And you kind of a friendly name for Luz is Lucha. And it's like Concha is for Concepción. And rather than saying, hey, the Concepción, you say Concha. And rather than saying Luz, because it's kind of formal and serious, you say Lucha. Kind of more personal.
So even after a hard day working in the fields, and it is a hard day working in the fields, she still had that joy to give you and to nourish you.
She sure did, you know. She sure did. And you know, because I was a tiny little child, you know, you're just barely growing, you're just starting to grow up. I didn't see the challenges she had, and I didn't notice them. You know, I felt like a child. I saw things like a child. And after a while, though, I did begin to get a little too serious because I noticed that she was having some kind of hard time, and I didn't know what it was. So I began to look out after her a little too early in my life. It kind of made me a little too serious, and it made me a little anxiety-ridden because I was just thinking how she was doing. And but the songs kind of took care of things. And yes, you're right, she did work in the field. And before I was born, after I was born, and my father too. You know, my father worked all the way until he was in his mid-70s in those scorching, impossible fields. I could only stand out there probably for 5 minutes just standing. Not to mention working all day long in that kind of heat.
Strawberry picking is really, it's unbelievable. The pain that, because you really do not stand up until you get to the end of a row. So you're just bent over the entire time, and you go down the row, and then when you finally can stand up, your back is breaking. And so that your mother maintained her joy of life and trying to instill, you know, the joy of learning in you is fantastic. It's fantastic.
You're right. That's right. Those are two big words. You're right. The joy of life, which she was always joyful, and wanted me to focus on happiness and focus on kindness and focus on respect for others and teaching, right? She was very much into education. Even though she only went to third grade, so she would chop out little articles from newspapers and hand them to me, or wanted to make sure I read them, or send them to me when I was at UCLA. She never stopped. You know, she never stopped her goal or mission or vision and her love. So she was always sending me materials, always giving me counsel, and never holding me back. Because she had been held back. She had told me those stories. So she didn't want me to go through the same limitations. So it was all about freedom, respect, kindness. And I think that's about it. You know, happiness. Four things.
Well, you know, the Chicano experience, it's a difficult, it's a difficult story. It's a difficult story when you were a child, and it's still difficult. But, you know, I look back on it. We were very poor, and you know, I wouldn't change it for anything. They were, in some ways, they were just, it was just such a wonderful time. We had a different kind of freedom, you know, a freedom to dream, which, you know, sometimes if a kid has everything, they don't have anything to dream about. But when you don't have everything, when you are taking a bath in a tin pail or a tin tub, as I did, now, you know, you were an only child, and I also. Now, you have to remember, everything came late up north. In northern Michigan. I mean, we got television like 10 years after everybody else. So things came late. And in my very young years, we still had a tin tub. And now, for me, I have an older sister and a younger brother. Now, my older sister was pretty like a princess, and she never got dirty. So she always got the first bath. My little brother always got the second bath. And because I was a tomboy, I always got the third bath. So, but when, you know, I look back on it and I think, oh, gee, we had fun. We had, you know, we had a lot of fun. And of course, I did a lot of reading when I was young. And you got into books, well, partly thanks to your third grade teacher.
Yes, thanks to my third grade teacher. And my third grade teacher got me into my voice. She made me aware of something that I had that I never heard about, and I just took it for granted. I didn't even know what the word meant, not really. And so after she told me that I had a beautiful voice, it was just a seed that she planted. It just flowered and flowered and flowered and until this very year, and it continues to flower, and I'm here to let others know that they have a beautiful voice, because that's how it all works.
And
voices cannot be...
Even with your difficult, you know, childhood, you graduated from UCLA, Stanford University. You got the Guggenheim Fellowship, and I don't know how many awards. I mean, I was going to like list them, but then, you know, I don't have a program long enough. You've won so many awards, so it just shows that, you know, dreams can come true.
Dreams can come true, you know, and a lot of people are involved in making our dreams come true. And that is why it's good for us to be involved in making others' dreams come true. Right, because it was Mrs. Sampson. It was a good number of my elementary, middle school, and high school teachers that looked after me, that inspired me, that challenged me with new amazing projects, theater, art, painting, art history, choir, singing, speaking up in front of audiences, translating into Spanish. And it just continuous. And they looked out. They said, you know, I want you to do my inauguration speech. And I looked at Tim White at UC Riverside. He said, I want you to. It was a new chancellor, and he said, I want you to write and present inauguration speech for me in front of all the UC presidents. And I selected you to do this. And it was just like Mrs. Sampson asking me to come up in front of class. And it was just like Mr. Schuster, who said, I want you to be in music band. And it was just like Mr. Ezra Harrison Maxwell, who said, I want you to be in madrigals. It's nothing I had ever thought I could do or ever not even dream I could do. And when my teacher stepped up and said, I want you to do this. And then I go, well, okay, you know, I'll do it. But I never even thought of doing something like this. So then I would do it. So, right, it takes a lot of good-hearted people to see something in you and say, I want to trust that person. And I know that person can do it. I know the person has never thought of it, but I am thinking about it. And I have this new... a larger sphere for this young person, and I'm going to bring him in. So that's what it's about, and that's what I'm doing now, because I have this position. I'm inviting everybody to do a lot of beautiful things.
You know, one of the things is exactly what you were talking about, teachers. If you can encourage teachers, you know, they cut out so much in school nowadays, but...
Yes.
Poetry is so important, And creative writing is so important. If children are encouraged to, you know, go above. I know one of your interests is bullying in schools, and you were bullied as a child, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And I don't know if you were bullied because you spoke Spanish or bullied because you were shorter. Or, you know, I was bullied because I had this up north accent, which I didn't know I had. You know, but we can overcome these things and grow stronger from it.
Yes, we can. We can overcome them because we're human beings, and we can adapt, and we can change very quickly, and we can, and because we can become inspired, and we have the ability to really connect with others, and that's what makes it all happen. But we need to have that inspiration and motivation by others to help us too. Otherwise, it's very difficult to grow. It's difficult to grow.
Well, you know, you're now that you have this position, and I predict that someday, you know, just like Robert Frost, our most perhaps our most famous poet laureate, was asked by John Kennedy to speak at his inauguration. I have a feeling that someday you're going to be asked by our first Latino president to speak at his inauguration, and. Because you are inspiring, and I think that your work, not just, as I said, your poetry, but your other work, as, for example, your portraits of Hispanic American heroes, has inspired young children to recognize the importance of Hispanics in American history, and it's a wonderful book.
Oh, thank you.
I love the stories. Did you have to do a lot of research on it? Was it how did you go about that? The stories are great. The illustrations are wonderful, and whoever drew the pictures really did a beautiful job. That they were drawn by Raul Colon. Oh, beautiful, yeah, Colon. Beautiful. And
yeah, he's a great artist.
And so you went back and looked at all of these heroes, and it was difficult to select. You know, wheedle it down.
It was difficult to select, and the publisher for Dial, the editor Lucia Bonfrey, she asked me to come up with a list, and I came up with a big old giant list, and then I sent them to her, and then she said, okay, you know, why don't here's my suggestions for a list too. So we kind of blended lists, and then I began working on getting the research done, and I realized that even though we have a lot of Latinas and Latinos that we know about, in many cases, because they're in the movies or they're musicians or the community leaders in some cases, and because there's some writing on them and those books that say famous Latinos or well-known Latina, those are, you know, good books, but they kind of are just accomplishment books. These are their accomplishments, and this is where they were born, and these are some quotes, and this is where they lived. They're really not stories about, you know, their challenges that they went through, and that's what we need, you know, for a good story. We need, what really did they face, and how do they overcome it? You know, what were their inner challenges and secrets and misgivings and triumphs and transformations. You know, we want some of that somehow. So then I called on, had to do some interviews, people that I could find, and the Latinas and Latinos that happened to have an autobiography, that was very useful. You know, Joan Baez has an autobiography. Desi Arnaz has an autobiography, a dusty old one that's impossible to find. Paperback from the 60s, and Jaime Escalante had a biography, and Roberto Clemente had a biography. So those were more accessible because there's a lot of material. And Sonia Sotomayor had an autobiography. So that was very useful. So that's what happened. And it took a lot of time because as a poet, it's a big leap to get into nonfiction. It's like going from California to, across the globe and landing in a different place. It was very difficult, and so I had to write and write and rewrite, throw away many drafts because I was just spitting out dates and things. And if I would have thought of writing it the way I write a poem, I would have been closer to the goal. So I'm happy that I accomplished that. It took me a while, and I had to learn how to write all over again.
Well, I think it's very well written, and you really bring the people to life. And I know one of my favorite ones. It was funny. I liked the Luis Alvarez one because you have a line in there and where you talk about Luis was born in San Francisco. And you write that his father loved to read books in his reading chair, close his eyes, and try to think of new problems to solve. And I just love that vision of a reading chair. You know, I have my reading chair where I sit, and that's my reading chair. And I think it's so wonderful. I try to encourage people not just to write, but people to read. And, you know, one of the there are more people. It's funny in some ways now with the Kindle electronic things. There are more people reading. People think, well, people aren't reading, but in fact, there are some really great best selling books out there. So they're getting people, partly thanks to J.K. Rowling, who brought a younger generation of readers to books.
That's true.
That, you know, there is a need for good writing, and as I said with this book, the portraits of Hispanic American heroes, it's well written, and it's the type of book that I think really will resonate with all readers, not just with children. So it's I think you did a great job with that.
Oh, well, thank you, Betsy.
Now I just want to talk a little bit about poetry. Poetry is a funny thing, you know. For many people, there are two types of people in this world, you know, people who think poetry has to rhyme, and people who think it's okay that poetry doesn't rhyme. Now, in your case, of course, you're free verse and prose poetry, which is so much more vigorous, might be the right word, because you can do so much when you can just write what you're thinking, what you're feeling, and so I know that I always try to teach my listeners a new word, and one of the words I really like is anaphora, and
yes.
You have of course a very famous poem, one of your most famous poems, I think, is a poem that uses anaphora, and it's, of course, the word is, explain what anaphora is and what the blood poem means.
Well, you know, it's kind of when you repeat a phrase or a figure and you just keep on going.
Like Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream.
Like I Have a Dream, yes. Yes, that is right. And, you know, it's kind of like a chant. And it comes very natural to us. And it's kind of also very ancient, you know, when we have the kind of religious roots, right? As religious roots. And we create a rhythm. And it's very mesmerizing. And it's also very accessible. And we all can relate to it. And I just love doing it. On that particular poem, I just enjoy it, and it's kind of what's going on with spoken word today too. It's a lot of call and response, and that's beautiful because you get everybody involved.
Now, are you prepared to read a poem for us today?
Sure.
I'd love to.
I'm a little prepared.
Poets have to be prepared, and especially now, you're going to have to be prepared at the drop of a hat. Every time you walk into a room, somebody's going to say, a poem.
Yeah, that's true. I was at the city council in L.A., and what happened was the moment came where I was getting a proclamation. I was getting an acknowledgement as California State Poet Laureate, and the president of the council says, "Well, we understand that you're, since you're a well-versed and agile poet, would you do us the pleasure of reciting a poem right here and improvising one?" So that was a great thing, and I said, "Sure." You know, I bowed down as if I was wearing a big hat and a feather in my hat, and I said, "Of course, you know, I like that invitation." You know, the poem I have right here, and I had a lot of fun, and I included some of the things that the people were wanting to do, needed help in doing in the audience. They had gone up and they requested some assistance in the neighborhood. So I included them in their poem, and I was very happy about it. This was called Poem by Poem, and this is something that I wrote for all of us and for the people of South Carolina and Charleston. It's called Poem by Poem. Poem by poem, we can end the violence. Every day, after every other day. 9 killed in Charleston, South Carolina. They are not 9. They are each one. Alive. We do not know. You have a poem to offer. It is made of action. You must search for it. Run outside and give your life to it. When you find it, walk it back. Blow upon it. Carry it taller than the city where you live. When the blood comes down, do not ask if it is your blood. It is made of 9 drops. Honor them. Wash them. Stop them from falling. Oh. So that's that poem.
Thank you so much for the reading. And
you're welcome.
I want to thank you so much for joining me today. You're an inspiration. You've been an inspiration to so many people. And I know that during this very exciting year for you, you will be an inspiration for more people and call attention to the importance of putting poetry in our lives and the joy of joining together in a project. Which is so important. There's so much that the world is such a crazy place in many ways, but there is this universal love and joy that we can find in each other. And I think you've done that with your poetry, and I'm looking forward to hearing more about your events this year.
Well, thank you, Betsy, and definitely I'm going to be inviting you and everybody to be part of it and be part of them and make it all happen.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I really look forward to it. So this is, I'm going to sign off now. This is Patsy with a Z, thanking everyone for joining us today.